a year. U.S. accounts for 40% of world military spending, more than the next 15 countries combined. So there's got to be strong pushback against this, because essentially it's kind of a new Cold War atmosphere, and it's an attempt to kind of whitewash the negative consequences of what these companies do. And of course, contractors get about half of that close to $1 trillion a year that we spend on the military.
Finally, if President Biden says he's warning Israel, for example, against a ground invasion of Rafah, but then increasing funding to Israel and military funding, what message is that sending?
Well, I think anything this administration says about human rights, the rule of law, the rules-based international order rings hollow in the face of what's happening with respect to supporting Israel in this war. And I think it'll reverberate well beyond this conflict. I think, you know, the U.S. will not be taken as seriously when they raise these kinds of issues in the future. So not only is it horrific for the people of Gaza, but I think it undermines the role of the United States in the world in any cases where they actually would want to play a constructive role. So it's hard to manage a more damaging foreign policy decision.
William Hartung, I want to thank you so much for being with us, national security and foreign policy expert at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We'll link to your piece in Forbes. Senate aid package underscores Washington's skewed priorities. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh here in New York.
You're tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kbu.fm.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, February 17th from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. for a special live remote broadcast of Keep Alive the Dream. Keep Alive the Dream is an annual celebration of the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This year's event includes guest speakers and musical performances from the MLK All-Star Band, Eli Hardy, and more. Again, that's a special live broadcast of Keep Alive the Dream, Saturday, February 17th, from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m., here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, ProPublica analysis shows state leaders failed to make Measure 110 work by ignoring or rejecting proposed solutions. Two Portland public schools are closed for the rest of the year due to damage from the January ice storm. And in national news, a study out of California shows police departments are enjoying record-level funding, but they're solving fewer cases. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 15th, 2024. I'm Althea Billings. State leaders failed to make Measure 110, Oregon's drug decriminalization law, work, according to new reporting from ProPublica. State lawmakers seem poised to recriminalize drug possession, pointing to open drug use and spiking overdoses as reasons why. But evidence compiled by ProPublica and OPB tells a different story about Measure 110's perceived failings. Oregon leaders in the state legislature, Governors Kate Brown and Tina Kotek, failed to deliver on the full potential of the measure, the report found. The measure was intended to divert drug users away from the carceral system by issuing them a $100 fine that they could waive if they called a hotline for mental health and addiction screening. The legislature, the court system, and the bureaucracy either ignored or rejected proposed solutions, including things like designing a specialized ticket to highlight this treatment information. They failed to fund a training course to instruct cops on how to use the new law, giving people tickets in order to point them towards treatment, something cops have resisted in the months since. They also didn't take action on recommendations to get police talking with treatment providers after the measure passed. Advocates who campaigned for and against the measure agree that leadership failures took away the chance for Oregon to truly test the measure's potential. Mike Marshall with Oregon Recovers opposed the measure, but he told ProPublica, quote, They didn't see that the voters gave them this really imperfect tool, but were committed to reducing substance use disorder rates and increased access to treatment. Instead, they simply tried to do the least amount of work to administer it to the letter of the law, end quote. Oregon lawmakers are currently in their short session this month, where they will be debating a recriminalization of the possession of small amounts of drugs. House Speaker Mike Johnson continues to oppose the Senate-passed foreign aid bill. A shooting in Kansas City leaves one dead and renews calls for gun control. And a new poll finds a fifth of Americans think Taylor Swift is plotting to sway the election. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The Republican-led House will not be jammed or forced into passing a foreign aid bill that was opposed by most Republican senators and does nothing to secure our own border.
House Speaker Mike Johnson might block the Senate-passed aid for Ukraine and Israel bill from reaching the floor because it's silent on border security. The White House has reportedly denied Johnson's request to meet with President Joe Biden about migration policy. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan plans to meet with the Gang of Eight, the congressional leaders included in intelligence discussions. House Intelligence Chair Mike Turner says they've learned of a serious national security threat, which reports say is connected to Russian nuclear capabilities. Sullivan is refusing to give details.
I'll leave it to you to draw whatever connections you want. All I can say is I reached out to see Turner. Turner's gone out publicly. I'm going to go see Turner tomorrow. That's where I want to leave things for today.
One is dead and as many as 22 were injured by shootings at Union Station in Kansas City, Missouri. Police arrested three after the attacks at the parade for the Super Bowl winning Chiefs. Missouri Republican Mark Alford reacted to the situation live on CNN.
We should be able to come together in situations like this and celebrate victories, not have to deal with a shooting.
Former Congresswoman and gun violence survivor Gabrielle Giffords is calling for an end to gun violence, pointing out that it's been 6 years since the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida. Kansas City Police Chief Stacey Graves says she's angry because people should feel they can celebrate in safety.
We had over 800 law enforcement officers, Kansas City and other agencies, at the location to keep everyone safe.
Long Island Democrat Tom Suozzi's headed back to Congress to replace disgraced Representative George Santos. California Democrat Pete Aguilar says Suozzi winning again in his old district means one less MAGA vote and a lot less craziness in the House.
It's a return to placing someone in that seat with the dignity to solve problems and to work in a bipartisan way to get things done rather than a sideshow that was George Santos.
Suozzi's return, the Republican majority is down to three, with three vacancies, which could remain empty for some time. Nearly one in five told pollsters working for Monmouth University say they believe the conspiracy theory that pop star Taylor Swift is involved in a covert government plot to help President Biden win re-election. Many who said that are Republicans, and almost three quarters of them also say 2020 was stolen. Flight attendants from three separate unions at the big airlines are picketing airports for new contracts and better pay. Corliss King with Transport Workers Union Local 556 was on the picket line at Chicago O'Hare.
This is the first time that they have seen a showing of like this worldwide of flight attendants who are absolutely determined to command our seat at the table.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A new report from the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice finds police agencies are enjoying record funding, but actually solve only 13% of reported offenses. Criminal justice reform groups are pressing for more funding for prevention and intervention programs. Suzanne Potter has more in California.
A new report shows that despite record spending on law enforcement in California, the clearance rate, that is the rate of crimes solved, was the lowest ever. Researchers from the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice found that the state spent a record $27 billion on police in 2021, but the clearance rate was just 13% for all reported offenses, down from 20% in 1985. Report author Mike Mails explains.
It is the fact that police are simply not making arrests. In Oakland, for instance, they have a crime clearance rate of 2% of serious Part 1 violent and property offenses.
State Department of Justice data show that San Francisco's clearance rate for all crimes in 2022 was 6.6%. The city's police department has blamed widespread auto break-ins for the low clearance rate. But Mails says that's not enough to account for the decline in clearances over the last 30 years. Some in law enforcement have suggested that Prop 47, which raised the threshold for a theft to be charged as a felony, has contributed to the uptick in property crimes over the past 2 years and to fewer arrests. But Assemblymember Isaac Bryan notes that Prop 47 saved the state more than $750 million in incarceration costs since 2014 and reinvested the money into programs that help people find housing, jobs, and treatment for addiction and mental illness.
If we provided economic opportunity and the resources for people to thrive and live their lives, we wouldn't see rampant theft.
Thomas Hoffman is retired director of the California Department of Parole Operations. He said we need more communities to greenlight halfway houses that give people who have completed their sentences a fresh start.
We need balance in our criminal justice system. The cops play a valuable role, an important role, a respected role, but they are not the entire solution. And if we think that we're going to continue to react to crime after it occurs and that's the solution, we're kidding ourselves.
For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
One person is dead and at least 22 are injured in a shooting after Wednesday's Super Bowl victory parade in Kansas City, and gun law activists have renewed calls for tougher legislation. Farah Siddiqui reports.
Wednesday's Kansas City Chiefs victory parade turned fatal, reminding gun law activists to call for reform. One person has died and three people are in custody following what was supposed to be a celebration parade for the Chiefs. Valentina Yusik attended the parade.
On our way home, we heard like pop, 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 pop. And I was like, I think those are gunshots. Things just can't go without being addressed. Something should be done. We can't just let things continue like this.
Former Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who survived being shot more than a decade ago, released a statement saying the celebration has turned into a nightmare again. Americans should not have to live in a constant fear of gun violence, not at a Super Bowl victory parade or anywhere else. Tara Bennett with gun control advocacy group Moms Demand Action says Missouri has some of the weakest gun laws in the country, and lobbyists are even now working to give more access to guns in places of worship, around transit, and other sensitive places in the state.
It's terrible, and it's devastating. More guns don't make us safer, and we have a proliferation of guns in Missouri. And we just had a shooting at one of the happiest days in our state.
The Chiefs put out a statement shortly after the shooting and said all team players were safe. Missouri Governor Mike Parson and his wife attended the parade and have reported that they are safe as well. For Missouri News Service, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
Two Southwest Portland public schools will remain closed through the end of the school year because of damage done in the January ice storm. Robert Gray Middle School and Markham Elementary will be closed for repairs until midsummer. The district had hoped to reopen the buildings in mid-February, but now that's pushed back to next school year. Students have been attending class at other schools while their buildings are closed. According to the district, crews have been removing damaged pipes, flooring, ceiling tiles, and drywall. They've been slowed by the presence of asbestos in those materials. If crews suspect there is asbestos in one of these things, they test it, and if it comes back positive, they start an abatement process, the school district says. At Robert Gray Middle School, the roof over the lower wing is a big problem. PPS says the roof has been in bad shape for a while, and the winter storm made the damage much worse. At Markham Elementary, the building's entire plumbing needs to be replaced because the pipes are so old. A replace-as-needed strategy doesn't work anymore. The elementary school gym floor was also destroyed by leaks. Schools are hosting virtual meetings for families in the next weeks to speak about this. Markham's meeting is tonight from 6 to 7 p.m. online. Robert Gray's meeting is on February 21st at 6:30. Not everyone in the region is out of the woods when it comes to winter storms. A winter weather advisory remains in place until Friday morning for the Cascade foothills in Oregon and southern Washington. This includes cities like Sandy, Estacada, and Sweet Home. Additional snow accumulation of 2 to 4 inches is expected, with winds reaching 35 miles an hour. Folks should plan for slippery road conditions and are advised to slow down and use caution when traveling. 2 to 3 feet are forecasted through this storm in Mount Hood, with 4 to 6 inches accumulating at lower elevations. In the Portland area, Multnomah County opened cold weather shelters last night, but closed them this morning, saying the warmer temperatures in the region no longer met their criteria. Oregon could list a population of orcas as endangered on Friday. Southern resident orcas have protections under the U.S. Endangered Species Act and in Washington, but their numbers have dwindled to about 70 in recent years. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Oregon officials are considering providing additional protections to orcas in the region. The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission will decide on Friday if southern resident orcas should be listed as endangered in the state. Kathleen Callagy is the Northwest representative for Defenders of Wildlife. She says there is a perception that this population was mainly off the coast of Washington and in the Salish Sea.
But a couple years ago, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration officially expanded their critical habitat because they found that there were some whales who were traveling as far south as Monterey Bay in California.
Southern resident orcas are protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act and listed as endangered under the U.S. Endangered Species Act and in Washington. However, their numbers have continued to dwindle in recent years, down to about 70. Callagy says added protections from Oregon could help the orcas battle their main threats.
We think that doing this listing will help to trigger interstate and intrastate agency collaboration on addressing their needs as far as salmon abundance, reducing pollutants, and reducing vessel traffic and noise.
Along with an endangered species listing, Callagy hopes the state will also adopt strong guidelines for how to protect these whales. She says it's especially important to increase salmon numbers.
The survival of these two species is interlinked. When we see Chinook populations go down, it's tightly correlated with losses among the southern resident population.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on world events from a human interest perspective. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 39 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 48. Today in history, in 2003, protests against the Iraq War take place in over 600 cities worldwide. It's estimated that between 8 and 30 million people participated, making it the largest peace demonstration in history. The quote of the day is from American director Miranda July, who said, quote, "My favorite thing in the world is when I look at a piece of art or read a story or watch a movie where I walk away feeling like, oh my God, I have to do something, I have to make something or talk to someone. Things are not the same anymore. And so I try to make work where you come away with that feeling. It's like, yeah, you're thinking about what you just saw, but even more than that, you feel able. You feel like kind of propelled." End quote. Haskell Indian Nations University is getting a funding boost for its agricultural business program, as announced by Secretary of the Interior Deb Holland. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Bureau of Indian Education and the Native American Agriculture Fund recently announced an investment in a new agriculture business degree program. The BIE is partnering with Haskell Indian Nations University, based in Lawrence, Kansas. Secretary of the Interior Deb Holland made the announcement in remarks at the American Indian Higher Education Consortium's annual legislative summit in Washington, D.C. The education effort will be housed within Haskell's business school, and the program will cover things such as lending operation, risk management, regulatory compliance, and encompassing comprehensive fundamental lending principles that will improve the relationships Native farmers and ranchers have with their financial institutions. In a statement, Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs Brian Newland said he's excited to see Haskell implementing innovative programs to foster opportunities for the next generation of Native American farmers and ranchers. He went on to say the new program will help ensure that indigenous farming students can build sustainable business models that support them, their families, and traditional food systems by bridging the gap between educational needs and agricultural financial literacy. Officials say the partnership will focus on building bridges between educational needs and ongoing efforts to improve agricultural financing, which they say is critical to a long-term, sustainable, and resilient Native food economy. A major transition is ahead for the Alaska Federation of Natives. AFN leaders have announced plans for Julie Kitka to step aside as president before this fall's convention. KMBA's Rhonda McBride looks at how this changing of the guard will take place.
Next month, AFN will open the application process, the first step in choosing the next person to lead the state's largest Native organization. In an announcement, AFN leaders said it was Kitka's choice to leave this role. Kitka was elected president in 1990, but her service to AFN goes back four decades. From health care to fulfilling the goals of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, Kitka has had a hand in almost every one of AFN's major achievements. Paul Ontagook, an Alaska Native historian, says it's always tough for a legacy leader to decide when it's the right time to leave.
No one lands on that one squarely that I've ever seen. There's an enormous amount of appreciation that needs to be given for all the time and enormous effort that she has put in year after year.
Kitka first joined AFN in 1984 as a special assistant for human resources. AFN's board of directors has created a succession committee and hired the 4-Acre Group to help with the search and transition. 4-Acre is an organization that helps nonprofits grow and adapt to change. AFN is also asking its members to fill out a survey to help them choose the new president. Ontagook says that's a good idea, and it's especially important for AFN leaders to hear from the younger generation, who may have ideas they would never even imagine.
The way people think about what that role is and what it should be, what it could be, for the future, it really does need to take a fresh bend of the river.
The plan is to have a new president in place by October to lead the 2024 AFN convention, the largest gathering of its kind in the state. Kitka says she has no comment at this time, but is not leaving the picture entirely and will take up a new role at AFN to be announced in the near future. AFN's co-chair Joe Nelson says it's difficult to imagine an AFN without Julie Kitka at the helm, but AFN leaders, he says, are committed to a healthy transition. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
This week, federal officials released highly anticipated data that serves as a guide for farming policy. The Census of Agriculture shows a national decline in the number of farmers, which underscores concerns about consolidation. Mike Moen has the details.
The U.S. has seen its total number of farmers and farmland decrease over the past 5 years. Advocates for smaller producers in South Dakota say new data indicates more challenges for farming communities. This week, the USDA released its Census of Agriculture. Since the 2017 report, the nation's number of farms shrank by nearly 150,000, and total farmland dropped by 20 million acres. However, the average farm size increased, pointing to concerns about industrial farms gaining more ground. Carla Huffenke with the South Dakota Farmers Union says it shows that farmers, especially independent operations, need effective policies to keep working their land.
Our farmers will produce more and more with the less acres, and so it's important that we keep the support of the Farm Bill programs going for them.
Congress faces a deadline later this year to adopt a new Farm Bill, and Huffenke suggests enhancing programs that offer conservation incentives is one way to prop up family farms. South Dakota saw its total number of farms decrease by nearly 1,700. Total acreage was down by nearly 940,000. Huffenke says if more small towns see family farms replaced by larger operations with no connection to the community, these towns will lose their identity.
You start losing your schools in those local towns. And when you lose your schools, you're losing your town, because the young families are moving away.
Larger farming companies say being able to grow in size allows them to meet global demand for food. Meanwhile, the average farmer age also went up in the new report. However, there was an 11% increase in the number of beginning farmers, with experts noting that could help ease the burden of not having enough people to replace producers nearing retirement. This is Mike Moen for Greater Dakota News Service.
Congressional lawmakers are calling for federal fiscal reform, particularly for improving Social Security. This comes as the program could face a cliff in the coming decade, but other short-term issues could put it in jeopardy. Edwin J. Vieira has the story.
Lawmakers and union leaders are calling on Congress for fiscal changes during the year, along with conversations about the budget and fair pay. Some lawmakers want more attention to Social Security. 2023's Social Security trustee report shows trust fund reserves could be depleted in 2034, meaning only 80% of benefits get paid. It will fall to Congress and the White House to resolve this, but some aren't certain how this can occur given split opinions on Social Security. At a rally, Representative John Larson spoke about how taking action on Social Security speaks volumes.
What we need is a vote in Congress on Social Security 2100, and not only extend solvency, but enhance benefits for the more than 70 million people.
Social Security 2100 is a bill Larson introduced that puts reforms in place, such as increasing benefits 2% across the board for all beneficiaries, restoring student benefits up to age 26, and improving the cost of living adjustment to reflect inflation. Average monthly amounts for single people in Connecticut are $1,700 per month, but average rent prices in the state are around $1,600. Aside from Social Security, rallying lawmakers were urging their colleagues to pass a full budget next month. Months of negotiations in 2023 led to several continuing resolutions. The current two-tier CR has part of the federal government run out of funding on March 1st and other parts on March 8th. Florida Representative Maxwell Frost says now is an inopportune time for a shutdown.
We can't shut down any part of it at this point. Not with the housing crisis we have right now. Not with our veterans being left out right now. Not with retirees needing what they need right now.
Lawmakers need to keep certain Fiscal Responsibility Act deadlines in mind. Breaching discretionary spending limits established in the bill could trigger sequestration cuts. In this case, the Office of Management and Budget has said if a budget isn't in place by April 30th, widespread cuts across certain federal programs will be made. This is Edwin J. Vieira for Connecticut News Service.
High school students are juggling a lot. With 7 classes a day, homework, extracurriculars, and often a part-time job to manage, high school students say their plates are full. But school counselors say teaching time management skills can help reduce some of the depression and anxiety that many students develop during the pandemic. Catherine Carley has more in Massachusetts.
Time management is an essential skill for academic success, but school counselors say it can also help counter students' increasing struggles with depression and anxiety. Educators report alarming rates of mental health challenges among teens post-pandemic as they juggle academics, sports, social obligations, and even work. 2024 Massachusetts School Counselor of the Year Colin Moget of West Springfield High School says it's a daily struggle for students.
Balancing all of those things is really challenging, and I think sometimes we're so far removed from that it can lend itself to the perspective that they should just be able to do it, and it's really hard.
Surveys show most teens see anxiety and depression as a major problem among their peers. Moget says he tries to be a sounding board for students to help reinforce their time management habits and encourage reflection about the demands placed upon them. School counselors do it all: academic, career, and college counseling, social-emotional development, and lots of listening. In Massachusetts schools, the counselor-to-student ratio is critically high, with one counselor for every 364 students. Moget says the work is unpredictable each day, but important.
It's hard to imagine the school systems across the state, nation, running as fluidly as they can without school counselors.
Moget has been recognized for helping develop his school's Terrier Closet, a service project providing clothing, food, and personal hygiene products to students in need. He also established the Renaissance Program, which recognizes students for good grades, attendance, and behavior. He says school counselors will benefit from increased partnerships with community agencies, which can help train counselors in providing improved wraparound services for students and their families. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
One company is breathing new life into giant wind turbine blades. They upcycle the blades into benches and picnic tables. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. All over the world, wind turbines are generating clean, renewable energy. But when they reach the end of their useful life, the giant fiberglass blades often end up as trash.
Our goal is to upcycle as much of the blade as possible.
Brian Donahue works for Canvas, a company that repurposes old turbine blades by slicing them apart and using each section to build a bench or picnic table. For some products, they turn a cross-section of the blade on its side and fill it with recycled rubber to create a bench. For others, they place a seat inside the curved walls of the blade itself to create a shaded bench. Sometimes, the bolt holes where the blade was attached to the turbine are still visible.
That really leans into that story and helps us explain where it came from.
To fund these transformations, Canvas lets people or businesses sponsor a bench for their local park or city center, which the company will affix with a QR code that links to advertising or a memory of a loved one. Donahue estimates that Canvas can process about 1,500 blades annually. And with thousands of old turbines scheduled to come down in the next few years, there will be no lack of used blades ready to find a new purpose. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 15th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Eric Tegadoff, Jill Freitas, Alex Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Mike Moen, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, lovely folks like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text the word KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global